Hello and welcome to this episode of Heterodox. Today we are going to be discussing one of the most consequential figures of the 19th century, the unifier of Germany and the honest broker of the continent, Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor. Very lucky to be joined, a last-minute addition, Marcus Pertinax, a sadly pretentialist, couldn't be here, but more than happy and grateful that Marcus can join us this evening. How are you, sir?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, AM. Yes, last-minute substitution. I doubt I'll quite be able to fill the Prudentialists' great shoes, but I will endeavour to do my best. Hang on, have we lost AM? I think we have. Hang on. I'm on my own here. Sorry, chat. I'm going to have to hold the ship here, proverbially speaking. AM's back. Okay.
Out briefly. So yes, you have a introduction, don't you, that you want to read out? So that could probably have a nice sort of intro into this discussion. So please go ahead and I'll try and get the screen back up.
Yeah, okie doke. Well, this is a biography of Bismarck's life by the author Volker Ulrich. And the foreword of the book is actually written by his direct descendant, who is Prince Ferdinand von Bismarck. And the introduction is as thus. Bismarck was neither the creator of a German unity nor founder of the German Reich, but it was he who re-established both. It is critically important to acknowledge this political as well as historical conclusion in order to counteract the prejudice that Germany is the youngest and the too lately established nation in Europe. Following a period of mass migration, the German people, together with the French, were the oldest people in Europe. Around 900 AD, it had already achieved this political as well as national unity. As Bismarck said himself on the 24th of February, 1867, there was a time when the German Reich was powerful, great, and honored because it was united and led by a strong hand. Its head and limbs share the responsibility for this Reich, sinking into the state of disunity and impotence. However, the longing of the German people for their lost possessions has never ceased. The history of our time is a history of endeavours to win back for Germany and the German people their past glory. Bismarck was determined to satisfy this longing. This aim was his life's work, and it is almost incredible that he achieved it in such a short time. Due to his innate sensitivity, it was at an early age that he, at an early stage that he realised the Germans' longing for their lost unity. As Bismarck was, like Goethe, a man of both thought and action, his open declaration of the Reichstag on the 9th of July, 1879, did not really surprise anyone when he said, "From the very beginning of my career, I have had only this one guiding star, by which way and means I could lead Germany into unity, and insofar this was achieved, how I could strengthen and support this unity and finally make it a result of the free will of all its participants." He made it his task to re-establish the unity of the Germans, which had been lost for centuries, and his ability to bring it about was due to his energy, sensibility, literary education, and expressiveness. His extensive knowledge and his pragmatic understanding of history were a requirement for his well-considered, imaginative, and as far as possible, successful politics. According to the historian Ernst Engelberg, Bismarck grew to be a figure of historical importance whose understanding of the world and far-sightedness have ever been fascinating to his contemporaries as well as to posterity. The German Reich founded by Bismarck is even today to be seen as the foundation, standard and legal basis for all German policy. His Reich was an important and strong country, but at no point predominant amongst European states alone. Bismarck set the benchmark for succeeding chancellors by demonstrating how, in the middle of Europe, German foreign and domestic policy could be turned into a policy of peace for the whole of Europe. His social policy was also a model for many countries to come. So there we go.
So that's quite interesting because I think that's actually quite a good iteration of the quintessential Bismarck myth. Now, my position on Bismarck is actually that his German patriotism came much later. It definitely wasn't a predestined goal from the beginning. And Bismarck himself would continually both glorify his own sort of forward planning, of which there was, you know, an immense amount, but also limit the perspective of what politics was capable of. So we have a series of wonderful quotes from him, because as you mentioned, he was in many senses, you know, a witty and literally capable, if not, you know, a literary genius in some sense. And one quote that has always stood out to me, if I could remember it correctly, is, "A politician cannot create anything. He waits and listens for the footsteps of God to sound through events. Then he wrestles at the helm of his garment." And what I see with Bismarck is a series of contradictions. I see a man who was originally a committed reactionary, who progressively throughout his career became a political opportunist. And in terms of like a strict ideological vision for Germany, I believe towards the end of his reign in 1890, and I really do mean reign, his position as chancellor was in many ways absolute throughout this period, except at the end. And there's another quote from his long-suffering master, Wilhelm I, "It has been no easy thing to reign under you." So when we reached the conclusion, I actually believe that Bismarck had no overriding vision other than confidence in the genius of Bismarck himself. So I'm going to run contrary to that view in many regards, especially the idea that Bismarck had some sort of unwavering commitment towards German unification. In terms of, you know, viewing this from a reactionary point of view, I also have some criticisms to make of Bismarck. Nevertheless, as we go forward, I really want to emphasize that, especially in the field of foreign relations, he was, you know, an exemplar par excellence. He was able to establish Germany as the hegemon. In many ways, he was able to achieve what Napoleon I set out to achieve and ultimately completely failed. So you have this genius enterprise, which is the creation of Germany from 1862 until 1871. And then you have the 20 years of moderation where he's able to peacefully guide Europe and prevent the breakout of further wars, and this is a policy that would continue up until 1914. So a lot to discuss with regards to the intricacies of Bismarck, but I think just in terms of starting off this conversation, I'll give a brief overview of his life. So he was born in 1815 in Schönhausen, which is a little sort of rural enclave in what was used to be Prussian Saxony, and he originally set out to study law and served briefly as a officer in the Landwehr, which was the Prussian Reserve Army, and returned in 1839 to his estates after the death of his mother to resume the sort of idyllic role of a Junker soldier farmer. And he remained in that position until 1847, when he married Johanna von Puttkamer. And this is significant in the sense that she was his rock for, you know, most of his life up until her death in 1894, after he'd been forced out of the position of the chancellorship. But also this explains his deep religious conversion to Lutheranism at the same time, because she was a deeply religious woman. And he was surrounding himself with the Gerlach brothers, Leopold and Ludwig von Gerlach, who sponsored his political career. Just in terms of, you know, setting out German reactionary politics at this time, Leopold and Ludwig von Gerlach, who were responsible for his sort of role in entering politics, were part of a faction which supported the Pietist Lutherans or High Lutherans, who were also absolute monarchists in favor of the Prussian monarchy under the Hohenzollern dynasty. The king at the time was Friedrich Wilhelm IV. In terms of the ideas of this group, this was the result of a paper circulating called the Neue Preußische Zeitung, the new Prussian Times. They were mainly under the inspiration of a Swiss philosopher called Karl Ludwig von Halle, who had written a gigantic work from 1816 to 1834 called Restoration, which talked about the organic conception of the state in complete opposition to the French Revolution. And I think it's fair to say von Halle's work also influenced the works of Thomas Carlyle, who again is writing just a little bit after this period. But before we get to the revolution, I think it's important to give everyone a bit of historic context. If you haven't watched the other video on this channel, which covers the Age of Metternich, I would advise you do so, because it's quite a good sort of part one of a part two drama of, you know, the concert of Europe, really, in terms of the foreign policy of the 19th century from a continental perspective. Because from 1815, we have the restructuring of the old monarchies of Europe after all the tumult of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. As you mentioned in that segment there, Marcus, this was a restructuring of the Reich. It wasn't, you know, an entirely new conception. The old Reich, or the Holy Roman Empire, had been dissolved in 1806, and it had been reconsecrated in 1815 as the German Confederation, with the Austrian Emperor as its hereditary president. Prussia itself did very well during this period also, because even though it wasn't able to gain territories in Poland, which it had possessed before the Napoleonic Wars, it gained a vast amount of territory in the West, in the Rhineland, in Westphalia, which would later become the industrial heart of Germany, in the Ruhr Valley, Dusseldorf, and Essen. So from a geographic point of view, Prussia is sort of much enlarged as a result of this, the treaty, the Congress of Vienna, even though technically it has to play second fiddle to Austria, which is the principal power of the German Confederation. Also, I think it's important to understand that during the wars of unification, the Napoleonic Wars, many of the Kleinstaaterei, or smaller states in Germany, had been, you know, consolidated from a number of about 400 to just under 40. And the effect of this was, as in Italy, a growing sense of German nationalism based on the French Revolution, i.e. one Volk, one community united by ethnicity and culture and language. And this is sort of one of the principal reasons for the 1848 revolutions, which, in addition to wanting to topple all of the kings of Europe in some form or another, inspired by the original, I think it was the February Revolution in 1848 in France, which deposed Louis Philippe, this spreads to Germany. And a parliament is set up in Frankfurt to basically try and hammer out this idea of a liberal German unified state. And this wouldn't just include Prussia, this would include parts of German Austria as well, and all of the small German principalities, which had been loosely united under the German Confederation. The effect of this was, from this is where Bismarck really has his political, you know, entry, because he famously assembles the peasants on his estate and he marches to Berlin to aid the king. But instead of the peasants actually being conscripted and being put into the army, Bismarck becomes part of the Camarilla, or the court faction around the king. And he uses this position to really voice his support unconditionally for the king and against German unification. The king, Frederick Wilhelm IV, had actually already been offered the throne of this liberal united Germany by the revolutionary parliament in Frankfurt, and he had rejected it on the basis that he would not accept a crown from the gutter. You know, Frederick Wilhelm IV was a reactionary king. He was a romantic king, and he believed in the divine right of kings. He was not going to accept a crown with a popular mandate, such as the Empire of the French, which, you know, had been all King of the French, as Louis Philippe or Napoleon. Anything else you want to comment on that? Because I've been talking for quite a long time.
Firstly, to say I do love that quote by the old Kaiser and King Wilhelm about it's nowhere easy task to have ruled under Bismarck. It's so fitting to their relationship. But no, yeah, Bismarck finds himself, I think, in my view, at a very interesting intersection of history, where you've sort of touched on it, where you've had this, you've had the armies of Napoleon and revolutionary France sort of march quite literally across the expanse of the European continent, only to be beaten back and to have the revolutionary France really dismantled. And I actually have watched your Metternich stream with, because you did it with the Prudentialist, didn't you?
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Yes, and I didn't get a chance, sadly, to listen to it again, knowing I was coming on tonight. But, you know, that Metternich really did try and use his position to sort of create this very sort of conservative, almost traditional orientation within Europe, and to sort of hold this structure against future sproutings of revolutionary forces. And for those who don't know, Bismarck's actually born in 1815. He's born the year that Napoleon is defeated and exiled. And actually the family state of the Bismarcks is actually overrun during this period in the aftermath of the Battle of Jena, if I'm not mistaken.
Jena's a bit earlier. Jena Auerstedt is in 1806, so this is nine years before Bismarck.
But needless to say, his family suffered quite directly from the consequences, is what I was trying to allude to. And so Bismarck is born into this culture, into this time frame, into this circumstance. And I suppose, to be honest, I take a halfway position between, say, the introduction offered by Bismarck's descendant and AM's position. I think there's probably an ember of him that probably had this sort of sitting within his soul somewhere. But at the same time, there's no denying that he was something of an opportunist, that, you know, he was a man of his time and probably no different to predecessors like Napoleon, like Julius Caesar, etc. Certain men in those circumstances have to react to certain situations with what they have at their disposal and with the options available to them. And there's no question that the Bismarck did do this. And as AM did quote previously, the quote about the God walking past and pulling on the hem of his garment. Sometimes people like Bismarck are sufficiently powerful that they can take advantage of that, but they are not powerful enough to exceed that possibility. So he's an interesting character in this way, for certain.
Yes, I think in terms of him really understanding that German unification is, again, in my view, a means of Prussian aggrandizement, rather than, you know, German unification being the end goal in itself, but rather, I believe his goal was Prussian liberation from Austrian rule. And to me, this is explained quite decisively in his early diplomatic career. So just in terms of the revolutions, the revolutions are principally defeated by military force. Leon Blum, one of the leaders of the German Revolution, is executed near Vienna. The Prussian state sends in the army, in many cases, such as Saxony, to put down the rebellion in 1849. However, there were attempts by the then Minister President of Prussia, Radowitz, to try and use this again as a means of limiting Austrian influence in Prussian affairs through the idea of the Erfurt Union, which was again like a proto unification of Germany, which would have emitted Austria. Nevertheless, this is reduced by the punctuation of Olmutz and the Austrian intervention to basically mean nothing. And by the end of the revolution, the pre-settlement, where you have the superiority of Austria over Prussia, is more or less confirmed. And it's into this climate that Bismarck embarks on a diplomatic career. Just to provide a bit of context, of course, he had, you know, briefly studied law and considered, you know, both a military and just a career as being a farmer, which is something he'll allude back to many a time when he threatens to resign to the king. Nevertheless, he's dead set on a diplomatic career. He's a talented linguist. He speaks French, German, Russian, and English. And he's appointed as Prussian envoy to the German Confederation of Frankfurt. So basically, his position is to deal with the other German princes, other nations and their reaction with the German Confederation, and principally the Austrians. Now, this is a moment where you see Bismarck's real animus towards the Austrians, because the Austrians, due to their position, have been afforded many diplomatic concessions which Bismarck did not enjoy, you know, silly things such as smoking. And Bismarck would enjoy taunting the Austrian ambassador by flouting these rules and smoking diplomatic meetings, etc. He even got into a near fatal duel over his various insults towards the Austrians during this period. But I believe that he remains envoy for 6 years. And during this position, he's also able to exert influence on Prussian foreign policy by preventing the Austrians to go to war against Russia by stationing troops, Prussian troops in Silesia. So, you know, his policy towards Austria is very, you know, explicitly hostile. And I believe it's during this position that he realizes that for the aggrandizement of his own country, Prussia, as principally a Prussian nationalist, it requires the consolidation of the other states, because Prussia alone wasn't powerful enough, he believed, you know, just to destroy Austria without resorting to Machtpolitik, the force of arms, which we'll see to later. So in response to this, the king, Frederick Wilhelm, has a massive stroke, and his brother Wilhelm is called in as regent. And Wilhelm uses this as a pretext to send Bismarck over to Russia as the ambassador, basically to keep him out of German affairs. It also didn't help that Bismarck loathed the Queen Augusta, you know, Wilhelm's wife. And this would be a loathing which they would have for the, you know, for the rest of their lives. It's quite extraordinary the lengths to which Bismarck would avoid ever trying to meet the Queen. Nevertheless, during this time, he cultivates a very fond relationship with St. Petersburg, which is going to be pivotal as we move on. During this period, he also cultivated, you know, alliances with von Roon, who is the capable Prussian war minister, and Helmut von Moltke the Elder, who was at that time adjutant to the Crown Prince Friedrich, Friedrich being the son of Wilhelm. Wilhelm himself becomes king in 1861. In 1862, he's recalled and he's made ambassador to France. And it's during this time that Bismarck is given his moment, his opportunity. The liberals, as we mentioned, you know, have been one of the main sort of political advocates for the German unification in 1848. And in concession to the liberals during the revolution, conservatives had established Landtags. This wasn't just in Prussia, this was all over Germany, to offer some concessions to the liberals. And during the 1850s, the liberal faction in Prussia was becoming more dominant. And in 1862, they voted against a military budget that would have allowed the army to increase conscription from 2 years to 3 years. And Wilhelm believed in this so passionately, he was actually prepared to resign the throne to his son rather than concede this issue over the army. And in this midst, he reluctantly calls Bismarck, who again is seen as the only man who is capable enough of pushing this through and dealing with the Landtag. And, you know, one of the first things that Bismarck does, that Bismarck demands complete and utter obedience from the king, which is, you know, sounds utterly absurd, you know, given his monarchist leanings, but he wanted the exclusion of the king from all his other advisors. He wanted him to rely exclusively on Bismarck, and that the king himself follow everything Bismarck does and doesn't even allow for dispatches from the king to go out without Bismarck's permission. And with this granted power, essentially, you know, giving Bismarck the position of a potentate. And this is, again, something significant as we get onto this discussion, how Bismarck, over the course of 30 years, is able to insert himself at the center of, you know, both military influence, civilian influence, and in terms of the influence of the court at the same time, to ensure that the entire system of Prussian and then German rule is dependent on him. And it's during this time that, in a initial attempt to try and woo the parliament to support his measures, we have the famous Blood and Iron speech, which is actually Eisen und Blut, Iron and Blood. And just to give you a bit of summary as to this, because it's quite a good indicator of what's going to happen next. The position of Prussia in Germany will not be determined by its liberalism, but by its power. Prussia must concentrate its strength and hold it for the favorable moment, which has already come and gone several times. Since the treaties of Vienna, our frontiers have been ill-designed for a healthy body politic. As you can see from this map, Prussia, the blue, is divided in two. So we have the segment in the west, which is the rich industrial area, in addition to some industrial areas in the east and Silesia. And the Kingdom of Hanover splits the two regions. So Prussia is basically surrounded on all sides. And it's also responsible for dealing with the French frontier due to its position in the Saarland as well. So Prussia has enemies on all sides, and it's not a cohesive, contiguous realm. And here we have the speech. Not through speeches and majority decisions will the great questions of the day be decided. That was the great mistake of 1848 and 1849, but by iron and blood. And again, you know, posterity has reversed that to be blood and iron. And this was the liberal deputies were horrified at this. They believed that Bismarck was a demonic madman, and demonic is an epithet that people will apply to him throughout his life. This alienates the liberal deputies even more. And so Bismarck's response is simply, well, we won't consult them for the budget. We'll rely on the previous year's budget, and we'll bypass Parliament until 1863, where he decided to fully abandon Parliament. Now, this is significant because we have the Crown Prince himself, Friedrich. And just to give a bit of context on Crown Prince Friedrich, he'd married the daughter of Queen Victoria, the Princess Royal, also Victoria, in 1856, I think. Yes. And she came with her, the ideas basically programmed into her by the Prince Regent, Prince Albert, wanting to transform Germany into a form of English constitutional monarchy. And so Bismarck believed that the Crown Prince was a security risk, both in the sense that he wanted to undermine the traditional reactionary mode of Prussian monarchy, but also in the sense that he was married to a British agent. And this is, again, another pervasive element about Bismarck, is his paranoia. In some cases, it serves him well. In some cases, he goes way beyond the justifiable parameters of the threat and damages himself in the process, as we're going to see. And as a result of this, he makes a speech, Friedrich makes a speech in Danzig, criticizing his father's decision to curtail the rights of Parliament. And Bismarck expertly uses this as a pretext to completely shut out the prince from all political decision-making processes. And from that point of view, he is a very effective soldier, it must be mentioned, and he's basically reduced to a peripheral role, as Bismarck referred to him, a decoration and a soldier. And this was, again, for Prussia, if you know anything about Prussian history, this isn't anything new. Frederick the Great's father, Frederick Wilhelm I, had such a powerful animosity with his son that he actually had his best friend executed. So this dramatic relationship between father and son in Prussian history isn't anything new. But in terms of Bismarck consolidating his control over the throne, this is really achieved in the same year, 1863, when you have the Schmerling plot. Just to give a bit of perspective, Austria had lost a war against France and Sardinia in 1859. And as a result, it's had been locked out of its formal position of hegemony in Italy. And so Franz Josef instead looked towards Germany for the future integrity of his realm. And so in 1863, his minister von Schmerling had an idea for a voluntary unification of Germany by petitioning the states to form a closer version of the German Confederation. And all of the princes acceded to this, and they met in Frankfurt. The king was in, King of Prussia, Wilhelm, was in Baden-Baden at this point. And the king of Saxony, King John, pleaded with him to go to this conference and acknowledge the unity of Germany under Austrian leadership. And Wilhelm, who his entire life had, he'd not been intended to be king, he was a soldier at heart, he was used to following orders, felt this gigantic obligation to his liege. And again, talking about the conception of a German Reich, the idea of the Habsburg prince, the Habsburg Archduke of Austria, the emperor, as the natural leader of Germany was so ingrained that he believed, despite, the Holy Roman Empire being long gone, that the Austrian emperor was his liege and he owed him a vassal liege obligation to return to Frankfurt and make himself available to surrender part of his realm sovereignty. And of course, Bismarck, whose whole grand project at this point was Prussian aggrandizement at the expense of Austria, could not have this. And so he cajoled the king during a very long carriage ride to drop all plans and to ignore the conference. And of course, as you can see from this map, Prussia dominates northern Germany. So Prussia not entering into this voluntary pact basically killed the plan. And from that point of view, and I think it's fair to say, he had virtual complete dominance over the king up until a brief moment where the king, again, almost sacks Bismarck in 1866, but we'll get to that later. Another important point to note at the same time, the same year, 1863, is that we have the Alvensleben Convention. as you can see, the old borders of Prussia corresponded considerably with the modern borders of Poland, and there was a significant Polish population in Silesia, in West Prussia, and in Posen. And in 1863, there had been a major uprising in Russia, the Polish uprising. And Bismarck offered his unconditional support to the Russians. And as a result of this, he basically acquired Russian neutrality in any conflict over the next 10 years. And this is going to be incredibly significant in terms of the later success of Bismarck, but it's a point which I think often gets overlooked by historians. So just to emphasize that. And now we get to the Danish War. And in terms of, you know, what the Danish War offered, well, it gives Bismarck ability to completely to consolidate his weak rule, because of course he's ruling in spite of Parliament. He's ruling by badgering the king into submission, and he lacks a popular support, a popular base of support. So he needs a war, and the Schleswig-Holstein question provides a great sort of way of Prussia to launch into a war, but also do it under the guise of German unification as well. So it satisfied all the boxes. Just to give you a bit of perspective on the Schleswig-Holstein question, the old House of Oldenburg had died out in 1864, and the throne was inherited by a junior house, the House of Glücksberg, which had these duchies as their hereditary fiefdoms. And so the new king of Denmark, Christian IX, decided to annex these territories directly into the Kingdom of Denmark. To put this in perspective, there had previously been a pro-German war as part of the 1848 revolution to try and unify these provinces into a larger Germany. But a situation called the London Protocols established the autonomy of Holstein. As you can see this map, the light blue area was part of the old Holy Roman Empire and the German Confederation, and the red area was a fief of Denmark. So uniting both of these regions was actually taking territory away from the German Confederation. And Christian X's solution was, well, we'll just join the German Confederation too. And of course, to Bismarck, this was, you know, completely absurd, because it gave Denmark diplomatic protections and allowed them to massively expand their territory. So this was flat out rejected, and he was able to engineer an alliance between Austria and himself to take over these regions. And then in the peace treaty, we have the Gastein Convention, which again, in terms of demonstrating Bismarck's diplomatic genius, in the Gastein Convention, we have Bismarck's supposed, again, attempt to display an alliance with Austria, yet at the same time wedded in its clause is an unworkable situation which will provoke conflict to give him a legitimate casus belli against Austria in the future. And what this is that Austria is given Holstein and Prussia is given Schleswig, and then it buys Lauenburg also from the Austrians. And the Austrians have no interest in this region. You know, Holstein is completely detached from the rest of Austria. They have no interest in the Black Sea. So instead of this situation with an agreement with the Prussians, they want to promote a duke, Duke Frederick II, to be the ruler of all these possessions as another member of the German Confederation. And it is this convention of Gastein, which is used as the pretext to declare war, because Austria looks like the aggressor, and as it's trying to undermine this convention, and it's using the machinery of the German convention of the German Confederation to do it by calling on its members to vote on the process. And Prussia believes this to be an act of aggression, and it's so it relies on Austria to mobilize its forces of the Confederation against Prussia. And this is what gives Bismarck basically the legitimate means of going to war. So here we are at the German Brothers' War, or the Seven Weeks' War, which is one of the most decisive military victories in history. Would you, because I, again, conscious that I've been speaking for a long time, Marcus, would you like to give a brief overview of the actual flow of military events? Marcus?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so after the second Schleswig War, obviously the Austrians and the Prussians are brought into a position where they've become hostile with one another. And this is where the Germans do have, the Prussians rather, have a couple of advantages to their in their favor vis-a-vis the Austrians. At this point in time, the Prussians have actually adopted a new type of a rifle. They've adopted the Dreyser needle gun, which is actually one of the first breech-loading rifles, as opposed to the old muzzle loading rifles, which take rather a lot longer to reload, and also under the well, following the reforms of Neisenau and Scharnhorst, under von Moltke, who AM has just referenced previously, a considerable number of reforms have happened in this sort of post-Napoleonic and post the 1848 upset, where the Prussian army has really been refashioned, and its strong points have been further reinforced, and its weaknesses have been quite comprehensively remedied. And combined with the ability and the rapidity of the ability of the Prussians to mobilize very quickly, they are able to assemble a number of army corps to the south of the nation. If you look on the map there, where Austria and Prussia have the direct border there in Silesia, and they engage, and the Prussians cross the border, they invade Austrian territory. And a little known fact of this war as well is actually the Italians attack from the south, the nation, or the sort of fledgling nation of Italy under the House of Savoy is a participant in this war in a quite
Marcus, I really do need to say this. No, I've forgotten something very important, and you just brought it up about the alliance. Something to display that we've been alluding to Bismarck's genius, and this again is an explicit example of Bismarck's genius. The alliance between Prussia and Italy is agreed in April of 1866, and the explicit terms of this treaty is that they would be militarily obliged to one another were they to go to war in 3 months. And of course, the war breaks out in the middle of June. So again, this seems to be perfectly engineered to produce the result that Bismarck needs. At the same time, we have the infamous Biarritz meeting between Napoleon III of France and Prussia, Bismarck of Prussia. And in terms of the significance of this, France is the dominant military power of this time. It establishes that after defeating the Austrians in 1859 and uniting Italy under its auspices, and Italy then giving the regions of Savoy and Nice back to France. France wants to expand into Germany. Napoleon wants to establish the old borders of 1802, the natural frontiers of France. It wants the Bavarian Palatinate, it wants the Prussian Rhineland, and eventually wants Belgium and Luxembourg as well. And so Bismarck promises Napoleon something he cannot give. In return for French neutrality, the implication is that he promised all of these territories to Napoleon III in return for staying neutral. And Napoleon, who had fought at Solferino, one of the major climactic battles in the unification of Italy, was pains to avoid another war. And so he seized upon this opportunity to seize so much territory and so much valuable territory. I mean, just to give a bit of perspective, had France kept its 1802 borders, had it had the West Bank of the Rhine, had it had Belgium, had it had Luxembourg, it would have had all the resources it would need, except oil, with massive deposits of iron and coal, and it would have been, you know, unquestionably the dominant power in Europe. So Napoleon was very anxious to get these territories. And it is through the Biarritz meeting that Bismarck, again, is able to understand Napoleon and appeal to his lust for these territories in order to get this neutrality. But again, that's going to come into play later. So sorry, Marcus, I interrupted you. So back to the course of the war.
No, that's absolutely fine. Just as a side note, because you did mention Solferino, just for those who don't know, the Battle of Solferino is actually where the Red Cross are founded, by the way, just as a side note, by a group of monks, I think. They come across the battlefield and are so distraught that they end up helping and starting the Red Cross or its predecessor. Anyway, to what we're saying about the Austrian-Prussian War. There's a really good quote here. Just let me find it in my notes. So at this point, Prussia probably has the most sophisticated rail network in Europe, and rail is still very much in its infancy at this point as compared to what it would be 20, 30, 50 years later. And and to quote Moltke, who actually reviewed the mobilization plans of Roon, stated that we have the inestimable advantage of being able to carry our field army of 285,000 men over 5 railway lines and virtually concentrating them in 25 days on the border. Austria has only 1 railway line, and it will take her 45 days to assemble 200,000 men. So Prussia is able to mobilize almost a much larger number of men, almost 50% more men, in under half the time, and they use this speed and rapidity of their mobilization to devastating advantage. They are able to cross the border with very little resistance, and by the time a few battles do take place prior to the major battle, the infamous Battle of Königgrätz, but eventually the Austrians are able to assemble sufficient forces and block the Prussian advance at Königgrätz. But Königgrätz is the magnus opus of von Moltke and of the Prussian state of this time period, and the Austrians are in a bit of a they find themselves suffering on a number of levels. I mentioned just before AM had to raise the other point that the Prussians had just moved to a breech-loading rifle, which means that they can have a much higher rate of fire. The Austrians are still using an old-fashioned muzzle-loading rifle. And in the actual war that AM was mentioning, where the Austrians are fighting in Italy against the Sardinians, the Kingdom of Piedmont, Sardinia, and the French actually utilize an advanced short fire, like a point-blank range fire tactic against the Austrians, which they themselves adopt. And it's actually the origin point of what they call Schloss tactic or shock tactics, which comes to prominence in the next century in World War One and World War Two with, you know, shock troops and what have you. And the Austrians attempt this against the Prussian army, but of course the Prussian army are able to wield a much more higher rate and withering rate of fire against the Austrian troops, and they absolutely devastate them at Königgrätz. And this actually brings about an interesting situation where after the almost unexpected decisive result at Königgrätz and the scale of it and the ability for the Prussians to simply move through what is, because Königgrätz is actually modern day Czechia in the sort of western portion of the old Czech Republic, the new Czech Republic rather, and the Kaiser and many of the Kaiser Wilhelm, Kaiser Wilhelm, and or who would be Kaiser Wilhelm, the Prussian king Wilhelm, wants to actually annex portions of the Austrian Empire and wants to bring Austria to its knees. And this brings about an interesting disagreement between Bismarck and the king. If you want to elaborate, AM, at this point.
Yeah, sure. Just to give you a bit of perspective on this, as you can see in this map, a lot of the, virtually all of the major German kingdoms, with the exception of Oldenburg and Mecklenburg in the north, sided with Austria, although it was virtually of non-consequence because Prussia focused all of its military energies virtually on Austria, with the one exception where they tried to invade Hanover and were actually defeated, the sole defeat of the Prussian army during the war. But during the, you know, again, the Hohenzollern sort of dynasty history, much of it was fermented by Frederick II the Great. And Frederick II had two overarching aims after his conquest of Silesia, which you can see here. Just to give you a bit of perspective again, talking about the French stupidity during this, the French had been offered an alliance with Austria in order to get these territories, which I mentioned. And Austria was desirous to get this territory back. So the war with Frederick II was still a huge part of the national memories of both nations. Frederick II had wanted to annex Saxony, which is just north of Bohemia, modern day Czechia. And he wanted to annex Bohemia and Moravia and occupy Prague, I believe, in the Seven Years' War. And so going back to this, Wilhelm, now in the position where he could actually act upon these gains, was desperate to fulfill the dream of Frederick and annex these territories. And Bismarck believed that would completely unleash the situation in Europe. He knew he had promised Napoleon these territories. And so a long drawn out war would make war with France over these territories he had promised in bad faith, almost very probable. And there was always the possibility that Russia would get in as well, as they had done during 1848, and start annexing vast amounts of territory in Austria at the same time. So it would have led to an entire sort of destabilizing effect in Central Europe. Also, Bismarck was far more interested in annexing the other German principalities. So as I mentioned, Hanover in the middle, you can see in the map here, the red, separating the two spats of blue, was a prime target for the Prussians, first of all because they wanted to erase the defeat they'd suffered, but also so they could link Prussia into one contiguous unit. Among others, other possessions, Bismarck also wanted to annex Frankfurt to completely remove any sort of prestige associated with the city as a source of German unification in its own right. And this led to a brutal exchange with the king, where I believe that Bismarck actually threw a lamp at him and begged him and wept and shouted and, you know, engaged in all these incredibly melodramatic positions which he would often with the king in order to subdue him, because again, he was completely dead set on this. And it was actually an alliance between the crown prince Fridrich, who was desirous of a general peace rather than an extension of the war, that brought the king finally on side. And of course, Bismarck wouldn't repay the king, repay the prince. The prince would still remain completely relegated to political affairs. But it is this intervention that wins Bismarck, you know, his desirous of peace, which is expansion into Germany as opposed to expansion into Austria. And the overall goal, because again, Bismarck is an incredibly long-sighted politician, is viewing Austria as a potential counterweight against Russia, as opposed to destroying Austria, being responsible for its internal politics, and having to deal with a possible Russian and French intervention at the same time. And at the tail end of this, we have Count Benedetti, who is the French foreign minister, threaten Bismarck, you know, you promised us these territories at Biarritz. And basically, you know, Napoleon had expected the war to be long and arduous, and Bismarck had to prevent it becoming so. You know, the war only lasted 7 weeks. And in response, Bismarck says, well, you know, my armies are still here. They're mobilized. If you attack us, it'll be the entirety of Germany against you. And so the French are forced into this humiliating position where they've been granted these concessions for neutrality and had gained nothing, because Bismarck had to fight a quick and decisive war and not gain the eternal enmity of Austria, which he basically achieves, even though there was a brief moment of revanchism or revenge in Austria, led by von Beust. So again, it's another sort of diplomatic triumph for Bismarck, and he's lauded at this point as a hero. And I have this quote from Steinberg here. The scale of Bismarck's triumph cannot be exaggerated. He alone had brought about a complete transformation of the European international order. He had told those who would listen what he intended to do, how he intended to do it, and he did it. And this is, again, a remarkable factor of Bismarck, is his incredible disarming frankness. When he was ambassador in Paris, he had met Disraeli, and in that position he said, yes, I intend to unify the German states in 10 years and to use the Prussian army to achieve it. And again, this is everyone thought he was insane. Everyone thought he was a madman, so everyone ignored him, but of course he did just that. He achieved the incredible feat without commanding an army, without the ability to give an order to the humblest common soldier, without control of a large party, without public support, indeed, in the face of almost universal hostility, without a majority in parliament, without control of his cabinet, and without a lawyer following the bureaucracy. He no longer had the support of the powerful conservative interest groups who would help him achieve power. And again, as I mentioned, he had been launched to power by the Gerlach brothers and this German Christian circle. And in response, because they, again, deposed, hated German unification. And Bismarck, among other things, had promised the German states universal suffrage for aligning their interests with Prussia. He began to be, you know, viewed as a total traitor from this end. So again, the conservative factions were pissed off with him as well. The most senior diplomats in the Foreign Service were sworn enemies, and he knew it. The Queen, again the Queen Augusta, and the royal family hated him, and the King, emotional and unreliable, would soon have his 70th birthday with perfect justice. In August 1868, he punched his fist on the desk and cried, "I have beaten them all." And again, it's an incredible demonstration how he is able to affect, you know, one of the largest sort of diplomatic revolutions in history. So now it is Prussia that is the leading state in Germany, and Austria, you know, again, as a principally an Austrian historian, you know, one weeps a little bit, but Austria is defeated. It is relegated from its positional from its position as hegemon of both Germany and indeed prior to Solferino, Italy, and it now has to become a eastern power content with satisfying the needs of its increasingly rancorous local populations. So we have the creation of the North German Confederation, as you can see on this map here.
Which you might say becomes the partial consolidation of his ambition at this point. Would you say,
yes,
Ian?
Yes, and as you can see, I mentioned the expansion into Germany. As you can see, the Prussian blue is much larger. So the territories of Schleswig and Holstein have been incorporated into a new province. Hanover has been annexed. So have areas of Hesse, and so has Frankfurt. Significantly, Saxony has not been annexed. And this is, again, in terms of the farsightedness of Bismarck, again, denying his king's wish. The intention of this was to give these states unswerving loyalty to Prussia, basically for not having annexed them. Because in the new order, in the new what's the administrative building? The Reichstag is created at this point, and you have the Bundesrat. You know, what in modern parlance is referred to as the federal parliament. But this was originally a princely institution, and Bismarck didn't have a majority of the North German Confederation votes in the Bundesrat. So allowing states such as Saxony to exist ensured him that perpetual majority. Other than that, he established the Reichstag in 1867 with its first elections, and this, you know, overturning many of the traditional forms of curial voting, you know, voting by a state, etc. We have equal secret ballots for all men over the age of 25. So again, I think only France at this time had been one of the countries in Europe to give universal suffrage to this extent. So this had been, you know, a complete diplomatic revolution, and from a reactionary point of view, of course, many people who believed in the absolute authority of the king were absolutely dismayed. But Bismarck at the same time believed that this was a concession to bring the German people around to him, and to also alienate the Austrians, who he believed were being capable of introducing these reforms, even though they were in 1906. Bismarck had no intention of giving them power. He believed that he was at the center of all this administration. He adopted the position of Chancellor of the North German Confederation. He was also Foreign Minister. He was also the Minister President of Prussia. He was also, you know, again, the traditional role of the farmer, traditional role of the Junker. All of these positions were held in the person of the Bismarck. So through his military alliances, through his relationship with the king, through his relationship with the Reichstag, Bismarck was at the center of this, controlling all of these factors and simply leaning on these for support whenever he need be, but very much prepared to discard them at a moment's notice to support another factor. And this is going to be a key feature going forward. Also, in terms of establishing the domination of Berlin in particular against Frankfurt, and the centrality of Prussia in the new Germany. And again, this is an aggrandizement of Prussia and not an aggrandizement of Germany. The Reichstag building is actually in the Prussian Landtag building. So there's this conscious association with Prussia being the hegemon of all of Germany. In terms of, you know, what happened after this, Napoleon III tried to expand, you know, into Belgium and Luxembourg, citing this treaty again with Bismarck. And he tries to purchase Luxembourg in 1867. And Bismarck, again, denying Napoleon what Bismarck had actually promised in Biarritz, refuses to allow the French to purchase Luxembourg. And so France is, you know, left isolated and without allies. Again, to give a bit of perspective before Marcus will elaborate on the details of the Franco-Prussian War, if that's all right. The Prussians had already guaranteed the neutrality of Russia. The Austrians were fed up with the French for not supporting them during the Austro-Prussian War and for having fought against them in the Italian Wars of Unification. So you would have thought that the natural ally of France would be Italy. But no, because Napoleon, in his bid to woo the supporters of the Pope, had ensured the temporal power of the Papal States by occupying the city of Rome, and so denying Italian irredentists their designs on Rome as the capital of a newly united Italy. So France was seen as the principal opposition to the unification of Italy, and so as a result, Napoleon had undermined, you know, essentially any would-be ally in this process. Of course, Britain had no real interest in this fight and was prepared to sit out, you know, something they wouldn't do in 1914. So Bismarck decides to basically force France into a position where, as with Denmark and as with Austria, Prussia has the moral high ground for his enemy declaring war on Prussia, on his country, for him. So we have the infamous Ems dispatch. Just to give a bit of context, Spain had been, you know, racked by civil war since the deposition of Isabella, and Bismarck suggested putting a Catholic Hohenzollern, Prince Leopold of Sigmaringen, on the throne of Spain. And this horrified the French, because they now believed that France was going to be surrounded on all sides by hostile powers, because, of course, Spain is flanking France to the south. And the Emperor Napoleon sends King Wilhelm an ultimatum at Ems, at Bad Ems, which is a spa town, and basically saying, you know, France will not have its honor, you know, besmirched like this. Prussia shall have no interest in the question of the Spanish monarch. And the Emperor basically says, you know, sorry, the King, Wilhelm, basically acquiesced to this. And so Bismarck intercepts the dispatch and changes a few choice words to make it sound like a counter-ultimatum. The counter-ultimatum is sent back to France, and Napoleon declares war. So, Marcus, would you like to elaborate on the course of the war?
Well, you really sort of covered it with the Bismarck placing Leopold in contention for the Spanish throne, and then the ultimatum and the counter-ultimatum. And Bismarck famously remarks that the only answer, the only appropriate answer to an ultimatum
is another one, another ultimatum,
which is another one of his magnificent quips. I mean, you know, you could look at it, you could look at a bunch of Bismarck quotes, and his witticism, his capacity for wit and language really comes to the fore. He's an amazing mind in this regard. Just very quickly before I hit the Franco-Prussian War, just one point, because AM did mention the Italian situation. Napoleon III actually does an amazing thing where he manages to upset both sides of the, both sort of segments of the Italian unification, in terms of the Garibaldini, the revolutionary side with the red shirts, and also Conte Cavour and the monarchy, by placing these troops in Rome. He somehow done the impossible of upsetting both sides. So that's just an interesting side note for anyone who is interested in that. So we have a, like AM says, the Napoleon had, Napoleon III had declared war on Prussia, and in earnest, the war had started. Now, what's quite interesting here is the perceptions of the two forces, and I won't go on this too long, because I know this stream could drag on, but when you look at the history of the French army of this time, sort of from Napoleon and onwards, and Napoleon, the original Napoleon, does have quite an influence on the French military and its transition and its evolution from his rule and going forwards. And there's this sort of perception of this sort of dashing French, you know, infantrymen and cavalrymen, and their uniforms are bright and colourful, and they're sort of, and Napoleon was really a master of manoeuvre warfare of his time, and that this tradition had actually carried through onwards throughout the century, and sort of was redoubled under his ancestor Napoleon III, his predecessor, his successor Napoleon III, and sort of the Prussians have this sort of, there's this perception of this sort of Prussian stiffness and lack of imagination and quite by the book policy, which one might expect of the Teutonic army structure, which is proven wrong in the Austrian conflict, in this conflict, and we also see it in the First and Second World War, that the, you know, despite these perceptions of Teutonic behavior, of Germanic behavior, they behave very differently in a military context. They have notions of I believe they call it Aufkraft tactic, which is sort of, you know, at an officer level, the Germans are compelled to act with improvisation, and frontline officers make decisions rather than sort of decisions always being made from high on command. And this tradition really starts in these couple of wars with the Austrian Prussian War and with the Franco-Prussian War. And so the French deploy the Armée du Rhin against the Germans just over the border from the Saarbrücken, which is the sort of the Saarland. That's just north of the French city of between Metz and Strasbourg. The French also have another, the First Army Corps, north of Strasbourg, right on the Rhine River. And again, the Germans, like what they did against the Austrians, because of their abilities to very speedily mobilize and send troops to very important parts of the sector with great speed and great authority and with great decisiveness, they managed to essentially tear open a gap through the Armée du Rhin, and the French actually fall back in sort of surprise at the weight of this German attack. They actually fall back behind Metz, but what the Germans do, rather than investing in the fortress and trying to break down the fort initially, they essentially encircle it and move on, and they cross they cross the Moselle River, they march on Verdun, they march on San Michel, then they march northwards up into Sedan, and Sedan's another fortress where the French are bottled up in, and essentially preventing the French from being able to field another land army in time. The Prussians bottle up the largest force which the French have at their disposal, the Armée du Rhin, into two fortresses, and the Germans, the Prussians have the First Army, the Second Army, and the Third Army, and two of these three armies have broken through the Saar, have crossed the rivers, have bypassed Metz, bypassed Sedan, and the Emperor Napoleon III himself is actually bottled up. I believe it's in Metz, in the first fortress. And the French are absolutely taken aback at the speed of the Prussian advance. And what's interesting here as well, from a technical perspective, is I did mention the advantage that the Prussians had with the Dreiser needle gun in the Austrian War. The French have actually developed their own rifle as well, the Chassepot, which is actually superior. But what the Prussians confronted against the Austrians was that even though they had an advantage in the rifle, the Prussians had an advantage with their rifles, they were deficient in the artillery. What they do in the meantime between the Austrian War and the Franco-Prussian War is they actually develop their artillery. They through the use of the Krupp, the famous Krupp family industrial company, they produce these new cannons, which are absolutely a massive technological step compared to any other artillery that's on the continent. And so even though they have the slight deficiency with the French in terms of rifle v rifle attributes, they bring to bear these new Krupp guns, and the Prussian ability to sort of bring bear to fire of indirect fire support against the French, well out of range of French artillery, at a greater rate of fire of what the French can achieve. So between this, they're able to smash the French infantry formations, and they are also able to wreak havoc on these French forces, the fortresses, which the French did depend on as a part of the defensive structure, and they absolutely collapse. And the French army, in a matter of, I believe it's a couple of weeks, they don't have military forces in the Rhineland anymore. They're absolutely defeated in peace building.
Yes, do you want to talk about the capture of the emperor himself at Sedan?
Oh, sorry, it was Sedan, not Metz. Okay, yes. Yeah. Actually, what did he want me to elaborate on in that respect?
Well, yes, again, I think this is interesting for many reasons. Kind of like Nicholas I, Napoleon III had a completely fatalistic outlook to this war. You know, he had basically gone through his prime in the 1850s when you have the autocratic period of the Second Empire. And then you had Solferino. And then you have a series of failed diplomatic actions in the 1860s. You know, one was trying to support the shogun against the emperor in the Meiji Restoration. One was trying to put Maximilian, the brother of the emperor of Austria, Franz Josef, on the throne of Mexico. One was trying to annex Luxembourg. One was, you know, trying to gain the left bank of the Rhine through neutrality in the Austro-Prussian War. And all of these measures had failed. And as a result, you know, Napoleon became, you know, far more sort of fatalistic in terms of his foreign policy. Basically, he accepted the action to go to war, even though it would probably doom his regime, because of the popular demand of the French population rather than his own desire in this campaign. And he'd actually adopted many sort of liberal measures. So you had this interesting phenomena where the emperor was at the front, you know, completely sort of fatalistic, completely doomed in the situation. And it was the Empress Eugenie at home who was actually trying to rally the nation to fight this war. So it's sort of fitting that he's captured at Sedan, again, the complete defeat of the imperial forces. And the empire just goes, you know, the Prince Imperial, Napoleon IV, is taken into exile in England. And again, Napoleon will eventually join him in exile at the same time. And France enters into its Third Republic, which originally started as the provisional regime to compensate for the lack of the imperial head. And this is where the war drags on. Even though the main imperial army had been defeated, the Prussians now encircle the city of Paris. And during this period, Paris falls prey to the Paris Commune, which is something I really want to cover on the Nations of Charlemagne series at some point with you, Marcus. But, you know, one of the most sort of dark periods in Parisian history where, you know, much of its heritage is destroyed and there's a proto-communistic state which is set up. But, of course, traditional among the leftists, you know, it falls apart due to factional infighting. And Bismarck, again, has this situation where he's wanting a more decisive role. He's wanting to shell the city. And it's the crown prince who, you know, begs him to stop. And then we have the moment of, you know, well, we have not just Prussia, but all of the German states bar Austria as part of this war. Something, again, just failed to elaborate is that not only were members of the North German Confederation bound to enter along the side of Prussia, but also the states of Baden, Bavaria and Württemberg, which hadn't been part of the German Confederation, were also bound to Germany during this point, even though Bavaria in particular did not want to see the unification of Germany. And this is quite a weird irony in the sense. Bismarck now has to manufacture a situation where you have this glorious moment where all the German states united against France to create the German unified state. And Wilhelm, being Wilhelm, will not follow in the example of his predecessor and accept a crown from the gutter. He is adamant in this point. He will only be acclaimed emperor by the wish of the princes in some, again, return to the old sort of system of the electors during the Holy Roman Empire, where there had been three princes of the realm and four bishops who made the emperor, so to speak. And Bismarck, being Bismarck again, has no sort of qualms about stooping to such methods. He pays the king of Bavaria a huge stipend to complete his castle at Neuschwanstein, the traditional Disney castle, in order for him to deliver the first acclamation. And of course, coming from the king of Bavaria, that has the most weight because by far he is the most powerful of all the kings. And with his acclamation, paid for by Bismarck, all the other princes fall suit, and they conglomerate in the Palace of Versailles, which had been occupied by the Prussian army. And I believe it's on the 18th of January, 1871, Germany is proclaimed in the Hall of Mirrors, and King Wilhelm I becomes the first German Kaiser. And afterwards, Bismarck is appointed Chancellor. When the Paris siege finally comes to an end and the government is able to restore control, Prussian troops occupy the northern part of France, and a vast indemnity is imposed on France. And just to put this in perspective, the indemnity was actually fixed to the same proportion of, to state revenue as the indemnity which Napoleon had imposed on Prussia after the battles of Jena and Auerstedt. So, as with the Treaty of Versailles being signed in the Hall of Mirrors, again, to identify Germany's humiliation, there is a lot of historical illusion being paid for in these treaties. Nevertheless, Napoleon is defeated. The French Republic is now, in session, and Germany is now united. And so now it comes to the manner of, governing Germany. And this is where I have my my sort of critique of Bismarck, because his domestic record is nothing compared to his diplomatic record. So we'll briefly go to his political record, and then we will return to his diplomatic record at the end, because it corresponds with the final sort of decline and dismissal of Bismarck. I have a segment from the same source I used in the Asia Metternich stream. So this is a Les Guerres aux Côtes by Desponchon and Malyaski, but also edited this version by Evola. Is that all right with you, Marcus?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Before the French Revolution, Frederick II, a friend of Voltaire and a generous patron of freethinkers, has stated, "The king is but the first servant of the state." This had merely been a prince's opinion, with no immediate practical consequences of his reign. It is difficult to imagine the sentence coming from Habsburg lips, or those of men who claim such things as "I am the state," "I fail to wait," and "the greatest person in my kingdom who is ever I might be speaking to," the moment I condescended to do so. Likewise, it would never pass the lips of Nicholas I or Franz Josef. This momentous sentence is part of the Masonic repertoire. It clearly illustrates the imperceptible spread of the new ideas through whose cells and affiliations remain utterly unknown. The prince is the first servant of the state, apparently. There is nothing wrong with this claim. Did Christ himself not say the same thing? The Son of Man has come to be served, but to serve. Did Christ not wash the feet of the apostles? But it was the popes and emperors who imitated this gesture of Christ's, not the kings of Prussia, as it applied to living men with not abstractions such as the ideas of nation, society, and the state. If princes are servants of the state, an elusive concept, rather than its lords, then there are no longer the servants of Christ the King or God, but of the state itself, the state which becomes God. What we are approaching here is the establishment of a state that seeks to replace God by situating itself above all in such a way as to identify itself with capitalism, nationalism, and ultimately democracy after 1918. Bismarck tried to take the bull by the horns by turning a feudal state into a capitalist one. The state, which had hitherto been only a means to improve citizens' lives, became a goal in itself, a deity to be worshipped. Religion, Protestantism in this case, simply became an accessory, as did the whole feudal structure, for the state which is now a materialist one. It was also strongly nationalistic, as it sought to claim the nationalist outlook of 1848 for the exclusive profit of monarchical Prussia by stripping it of its democratic overtones. It was apparently successful at the first. Much discussion has been made about the political transformation of Germany under Bismarck's drive. There's been less talk about the economic and social transformation of the country, which was more subtle, but much more important. No economic and social transformation, as radical and rapid, has ever taken place under the rule of one man. The city of Berlin alone witnessed its population increase tenfold. The same occurred in Hamburg and many other cities, particularly in the coal basin of the Rhineland. The whole consumption and production was suddenly replaced by a circulation of goods and capital. At the time of Bismarck's death, Germany was one of the countries with the most intense capitalist life. It was ahead of France and Britain in this respect, and almost on par with the United States. When Bismarck had come to power in Prussia, it had merely been a loose federation of feudal and agrarian states. Under the impulse of this Prussian squire, the idyllic motherland of Hermann and Dorothea, Hermann, of course, being a reference to Arminius, and Dorothea being the precursor of the originator of the Grimm's tales, which were later, you know, conscribed under Jacob Grimm in the 19th century, became a country of great financial wealth and proletarian misery. Germany came to be known as a flourishing country that was growing richer and richer. In all good faith and with no exceptions, Germany seemed to be very proud of this. They never wondered why they themselves or those close to them were not growing any wealthier when the country, their country, was meant to be taking such giant steps forward in terms of economic progress. What do you think of that assessment?
I don't think it's very, very far from the truth at all. It sort of shows the great strides that Germany made, but also be it as a part of Bismarck's policies directly as a result of his chancellorship, or just the sort of evolution of the state in a post-unification context, I think reveals a lot of truth that, you know, there was a lot of benefit to Germany and its people, but there was also something of an underside, as I think those of us who think as we do understand about the process of modernization. It's never one-dimensional.
Yes, I think when it comes to the actual nature of capitalism, I mean, this source is very vague in terms of what it refers to as that. I think it's important to note that free trade was the original policy of Bismarck, because he originally formed an alliance with the National Liberals. Again, this shows, well, Bismarck again referred to political allegiance as useless luxuries. So he would drop and promote certain factions, whichever served his goals at the time. And we're going to see this. And again, this more aligns with the fact that he was principally a opportunist and more interested in, again, his own aims, which, as far as I'm concerned, still are the aggrandizement and sovereignty of the Prussian state and now the German hegemony, other than any sort of overall reactionary goal. And this is in terms of the economy, for example. He initially pursued a free market strategy. And then you have the Great Depression in the 1870s, you know, the original Great Depression. And to protect the industrial capacity of the Ruhr, and you mentioned the Krupp factory, of course, the Krupp factory in Essen, he decided against unbridled capitalism, and he adopted protectionism and import tariffs. So he adopted a far more sort of nationalistic, mercantilist policy, and I'll argue later that this actually impacts his foreign policy as well. So moving on, we have his association with the Kulturkampf, but there's an interesting paragraph I just want to read before that.
Oh, just before you start, if I may, very briefly, this also, just what you mentioned about the change of policy from free market economic policies to mercantilism and more insular economic policies, that also, these changes also happen in the context of A, you mentioned the Kulturkampf, and B, also he's flip-flopping on the colonial policy, which is also part of the foreign policy. So absolutely. I suppose we'll get to that in due course. So go ahead.
Absolutely. Bismarck is the man who bestowed the crown of unified Germany upon Wilhelm I. Yet, and this was something far more serious, he was also one of the men who contributed the most to the crowning of Mammon. And of course, the Mammon in the Bible is, you know, the worship of material things over the spiritual. As king of the earth, at a time in which Marx and LaSalle, and also important to note, Ferdinand LaSalle, was a friend of Bismarck. Bismarck would refer to him as the practical, honest socialist, followed by Liebknecht and Babel, were carefully observing the march of progress as it swept across the center of Europe. Bismarck certainly wasn't a democrat in the most obvious and ordinary sense of the term. By birth, he belonged to a class which was particularly loyal towards the Prussian monarchy, that of the Junkers, that of the small landed gentry of Prussia. He was therefore a fervent royalist, but his royalism was of a strictly Prussian sort, and only became German when Prussia itself turned into Germany. It was never European and historic as Metternich's royalism had been. Unlike Metternich, Bismarck did not see the presence of two international and historic fronts engaged in a struggle that had been going on for generations, and by that he means the forces of the French Revolution. He did not realize that Europe was about to become a single body whose various organs would increasingly react against one another. All he saw were the ready profits of monarchical Prussia could become by being the ubiquitous tool of capitalism, even to the detriment of the monarchical idea. Bismarck was a great Prussian, but a small European. He knew that the monarchy was a point of strength and wanted it for his own country, but for the same reason, he also wanted liberalism for the potential enemies of Germany, and this would have been a point of weakness and inferiority for them. All countries, in fact, represented potential enemies, as Germany was above all. And this, again, is something we're going to talk to when it comes to the Kulturkampf and his foreign policy. Bismarck humiliated and weakened Austria, the citadel of the feudal nobility. He fought against Catholicism and the Holy See, which is to say against the very principle behind divine right. He called this fight Kulturkampf, the fight for civilization. Is this not the language of the men of progress and at home in the Masonic Lodge? And this is to give a bit of perspective on the Kulturkampf. Sorry. Now, this policy was launched in 1871, and to give you a bit of perspective, in 1870, you'd had the first Vatican Council, and you'd had the formal pronunciation on papal fallibility, which again was more in line with ultramonetism during this period. And this wasn't a novel invention, because nothing in Catholic thought is ever supposed to be novel. Rather, this was a clarification of a position which had, you know, been assumed for centuries and centuries up to that point. And of course, it was adopted by De Maistre, who died, you know, 50 years before the this formal declaration on papal infallibility. So it wasn't new, but this declaration of it, you know, disproportionately alarmed quite a lot of countries in Europe. A third of Prussia's population was Catholic. And in response to this, a Catholic party, Zentrum, which would, you know, later sort of redesignate itself as the Christian Democratic Union in Germany, you know, which is today's modern party, and, you know, completely deracinated from all of its founding principles, was established in 1870. And this policy wasn't just launched in Prussia also. Again, this wasn't a federal policy. It wasn't an all-German policy. It was a local policy. You know, many diets approved of this policy. And, you know, in Prussia, Bismarck pursued it, you know, very rigorously. And it was aimed, you know, principally at curbing the political influence of the Catholic Church, because Bismarck was obsessed with sovereignty. And, you know, his paranoia kicked in, as it had with the Princess Royal and Friedrich, where he believed the Pope was acting as a subversive agent interfering in German politics. The irony being, of course, he was completely prepared to do that the other way around. He even tried to manipulate papal elections. He wanted countries to commit to controlling their cardinal voters and ensuring that they would have suitable popes elected who would not meddle in the affairs of Germany. And of course, this completely failed because he couldn't muster the support among Catholic countries. Also, I'll get more into this when we're talking about his foreign policy mistakes. But he was actually prepared to support Adolf Thiers, which had been the more secularist pro-republican president of France, against MacMahon. He abolished the Catholic cultural ministry in Prussia. He expelled the Jesuits. And again, to put this in perspective, to be completely fair to Bismarck, the expulsion of the Jesuits was no new thing. Expulsion of the Jesuits actually has a very long history. As far as I'm aware, it goes back to the 1750s, when a lot of enlightened despots, you know, whether it be the King of Portugal, whether it be the King of Spain, whether it even be the Duke of Bavaria, banned Jesuit practices, you know, throughout the pre-French Revolution era, because many of them were wanting to secularize their administrations. So this isn't something new. But nevertheless, the government in Prussia was made responsible for supervising the education of Catholic clergy, and even imprisoned priests and bishops and forced others to go into exile. However, I think this again shows the limits of Bismarck's genius, because the Kulturkampf actually produced the opposite effect. I mean, it should also be noted that the declaration of papal infallibility caused a schism in the Catholic Church with the old Catholics the old Catholics, ironically, who have now become far more progressive than the Catholic Church. Many of the bishops in Germany had opposed the Ultramontanist movement and the declaration of papal infallibility. But now the German bishops were under attack. Zentrum, under the leadership of the wily and very charismatic Ludwig von Windthorst, became a major political movement in Germany, one of the principal parties. And many of the German bishops who had originally resisted Ultramontanism and would have actually sided with Bismarck were now pro-Ultramontanism because they felt the Catholic Church was under attack. I mentioned the fact that Bismarck was originally, you know, siding with the National Liberals, kind of like what we see in the Spanish Second Republic before the Civil War. The Liberals were anti-clericals, and so they went along with this policy because it served their aims of, you know, increasing, you know, secular education and secular power. However, the other effect of this was it increased the power of the socialists, who also wanted not just the diminution of the authority of the Catholic Church, but the diminution of all churches. And of course, Bismarck wasn't imposing this as an atheist. He was imposing this as a Lutheran. He wanted Germany to be a pietist Lutheran state, and he wanted to limit the Catholic influence, but he didn't want to abolish church. He wanted the church to have a principal position, you know, in society. I think it's also important to note that this also had other domestic ramifications in the fact that a large section of Prussia's Poles, of which Bismarck again was very hostile, were also Catholic. So this wasn't just a anti-Catholic measure, but this was also an anti-Polish measure. Nevertheless, it had the opposite effect and actually strengthened the Catholic opposition. And so by 1878, Bismarck decides to take a new course and attack the socialists. And he relies on Ludwig Windthorst to help him in this endeavor, and actually negotiates with the new Pope, Leo XIII, to undo most of the Catholic legislation during this period. So from all respects, you can sort of regard this policy as a self-own in many senses, because it weakened the social conservative movement in Germany against the secularist forces. And again, it was a complete failure, and he even tried to implement this policy in France, as we're going to elaborate on. Bismarck contributed to the republicanism and democratization of France in order to humiliate and demean this great country. As for his own country, Bismarck turned feudalism, which had been its very social frame, into nothing but a mere pretense. And again, this is the allusion to the Prussian aristocracy in particular. And again, you can see the East is far more agrarian than the West. And Prussia remained a far more agrarian country in general, and Germany in general, until, you know, right up until the beginning of the 20th century, compared to, say, you know, England at the same time. So in terms of, like, focusing Prussia on, you know, lack of a better word, you know, line go up, he was, you know, attacking the very basis of the service nobility, which relied on the land. In fact, he, you know, himself was one of them, and he had been a farmer. He replaced it with a state bureaucracy, which is what Richelieu had done in France, forgetting that a mere turnover of people would have been enough to turn the system into a state democracy or socialism. Bismarck, in other words, fell under the spell of imperialist capitalism. The reason for this is the fact, blinded by his nationalist pride, he trusted Prussia to be exceptionally immune to certain influences. Bismarck drove his own country, and in doing so, all others too, down the road of militarization, to the point that universal conscription was the way to say armed masses became the rule throughout Europe. Bismarck was only naively seeking to increase the military power of Germany vis-a-vis its neighbors. What he failed to realize was that these neighbors, who would have followed Germany and hence the balance of power, was destined to remain substantially the same. The balance which did change in Germany as elsewhere was the possibility of class war. Either Bismarck was nothing but a false reactionary, a conscious tool of subversion who behaved like Judas towards the Ancien Régime, in which case he did give proof of his genius, or his alleged genius merely consisted of being the most unlikely fool of the century. In this respect, Bismarck far outdid Richelieu. In demolishing feudalism, the latter stripped the Kingdom of France down to the bone, so to speak, in order to bring about the rise of a king who could claim, "I am the state." Precisely because of this claim, the state was all the more easily guillotined later in the person of the king. Still, Richelieu had not experienced almost a century of revolutionary strategies. Bismarck proved all the more foolish because he possessed undeniable intelligence and shrewdness. These virtues, however, remain enclosed within the narrow boundaries set by contingent ambitions of the Hohenzollern and the self-serving interests of Germany. Within these boundaries, Germany was regarded not as simply as über alles, meaning above everything, which would have been understandable from a German perspective, but beyond all, sheltered, that is, from the currents that made all parts independent and thus situated outside of universal history. What was essential and permanent in the 19th century was the implacable antagonism, not between two nations, but between two superimposed worlds, the upper world, which contained to lie under the influence of traditional Christianity, and the lower world. The latter concealed itself by taking the twofold form of capitalism and was opposed to personal ownership, democracy, bourgeois at first, and later socialist, which opposed legitimate authority. The lower world was intentionally united in thought and deed, no enemy on the left. The upper world was divided by nationalism, France de Bord, Deutschland über alles, Rule Britannia. Hence the manifest inferiority of the latter of these words, given such conditions, things could have gone no differently. Like all his contemporaries bar none, Bismarck found it easier to act as an opportunist, in other words, not to go against the historical current created by the forces of subversion, but to follow it, seeking to exploit this current in order to fulfill his contingent ambitions and those of his country. Now, getting to what this, the ultimate effect of what this had on France in particular, and this really exemplifies this point of going with the currents in order to strengthen Prussia's ambition, sacrificing any sort of ultimate or sort of universal goal or even a European goal, as I argued in my Age of Metternich stream. In France, Bismarck was deliberately helping republicanism against monarchism. You had the Adolf Thiers regime, which was actually replaced in 1873 by the more conservative regime of MacMahon. And this was during the time of Kulturkampf. So he favored the Adolf Thiers regime. He favored the Republicans against MacMahon, who could have established again a more conservative, in his own words, MacMahon tried to create the moral order. He favored the Spanish Republic, which, you know, was the Spanish situation is too difficult to get into on this stream. But nevertheless, Spain was, you know, perpetually in a state of instability from 1868 until 1874, and Bismarck was on the side of the Republicans. In addition, he extended this policy towards Belgium as well. Again, the idea to prevent a pro-Catholic lobby, supposedly allying with the Pope to undermine German influence by appealing to the Catholic population there. So again, this extends to his paranoia and how he was willing to undermine conservatism in other countries to satiate what he believed to be the national security of Prussia. And this is so significant, it actually precipitated a near coup. I mentioned the fact that Bismarck was reliant on his genius statesman position in order to rely on, you know, cajoling the king, cajoling parliament, cajoling the bureaucrats, cajoling the foreign office. Well, the ambassador to France from Germany, Harry von Arnim, used this as an attempt to actually try and claim that he was far more far-sighted than Bismarck and to actually, you know, make a claim, a bid on the chancellorship by actively supporting the conservative faction in France, actively supporting MacMahon and leaking diplomatic dispatches about, you know, Bismarck's intentions to deliberately undermine Bismarck's foreign policy. In response to this, Bismarck actually changed the law to make that a criminal offence. And, you know, this was in Germany referred to mockingly as the Arnim paragraphs, i.e. the law specifically relating to a crime committed by this one person. And Arnim, in response, you know, his claims of going back to Germany and becoming chancellor were frustrated by this. And he only avoided imprisonment by staying outside Germany and eventually died, you know, in his 50s in Nice. So this was a very controversial policy, not just within Prussia, but within the Foreign Office itself, that he was prepared to support the forces of republicanism against conservatism. And this gets to, you know, the ultimate bit of him being a crafty and opportunistic politician first. As Bismarck was wiped out, the most skilled, crafty, and resourceful diplomat of his age, he managed to outdo all of his colleagues as far as opportunism went and achieve brilliant success, while unconsciously playing the game of international subversion. And this is where I sort of am reminded of another wonderful Bismarck quote. Die Politik ist die Lehre von Möglichen. Politics is the art of the possible. So I've mentioned before the idea of him sort of having to deal with the socialists. And him having to then rely on the force which he created, the consolidated Catholic Party in Zentrum, in order to deal with this. And this gets to the next part where Bismarck's policy falls apart a bit. But before I get onto that, do you have anything to say on any of the things that Malitzki and de Pontchaux and Evola brought up?
Well, at the start of the stream, and actually before we came live, you're sort of saying that you're going to take this slight critique angle from Bismarck, and I sort of said to you that I'm probably halfway between that. Certainly since what you've been citing since and what you've been reading and bringing forth to the audience and myself, I can certainly see the merit in the critiques brought before Bismarck. And I guess for those of us who have rather more peripheral knowledge of Bismarck, I mean, I've obviously read, you know, a bit about him and know about his domestic policy in Germany, but certainly his willingness to corrode the strength of conservative right-wing reactionary nationalist movements, call them what you wish, outside of Germany, it certainly makes him a less of a philosophically consistent individual than, say, Metternich, who you might say championed that cause strongly within Austria and obviously beyond Austria. And in a really ironic way, by undermining these movements beyond Germany, he might have secured the strength and the hegemony of Germany in a more immediate context time-wise. But by having a Republican France to its west and having a contentious relationship with the Anglos on the other side of the channel, who practiced their form of constitutional monarchy, it kind of doomed Germany in a way that they would have seen Germany as the sort of bastion of this kind of I don't know if retrograde is really the right word, but you might say a troublesome imperial sort of thorn in the side of Europe that had to be dealt with, which is, you might argue, one of the motivations for having got rid of the Kaiser in 1918 at the culmination of the end of the First World War. And it's quite evident to see that perhaps Bismarck and his policies in this period in this regard might be somewhat responsible for that. I've never thought of that, but that's the conclusion I've since come to having listened to you. And the second thing I wanted to quickly mention is, because I didn't want to sort of break your train of thought there when you're talking, but what we have to consider too is, I'm assuming most people in the chat probably know, but predominantly with Germany, the split between Catholics and Protestants is the Rhineland, Bavaria and Swabia, sort of the west and the south of Germany is predominantly Catholic, and the remainder is predominantly Protestant in the north and the east, with the exception of, in this map, with Germany actually genuinely having East Germany, the Prussian provinces, Pomerania and Silesia, in which there are Catholic Polish minorities, the remainder is quite Protestant. And with the formation of the unified German Empire after the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, the proportion of Catholics in Germany greatly increases. And the balancing act, this walking of the line between pro-Protestant policy and also tolerating Catholics in what is a Protestant nation with a Protestant monarchy, a Protestant king, becomes ever more difficult and yes, plays a part in the Kulturkampf.
Yes, and I think, again, as we see later with his alliances with the Zentrum Party, I do believe this was an own goal, in a sense, that he believed that the Catholics in Germany were his enemy, that they were conspiring with the Pope to undermine, you know, the integrity of the Germany, or that the Poles were conspiring with each other. I believe this was, you know, an unjustified threat, you know, that the High Church Lutherans and the Catholics actually had something in common, which was their opposition to socialism. And this is really where Bismarck next turns to post-1878. And this is where we have, again, another controversial element. And this is already sort of elucidated in some of the points that de Pontchaux, Malitzki and Evola have made.
Just very quickly, A.M., just as well, we have to consider, too, that with the Habsburg monarchy themselves being Catholic and Austria sort of being this bastion of Catholic German culture or Catholic German hegemony in the south, this adds another dimension to that as well.
Absolutely. And this, you know, I think this bolsters the point I was going earlier, where Bismarck had this, or you can almost say irrational phobia of Austria, dating back from his time as the German minister to the Bund at Frankfurt, where it was everything associated with Austria which he opposed. And this again was an extension of that Prussia was no longer to be Catholic, or even to have this wedded association, you know, going back from the Peace of Westphalia, that each state has its religion. No, Prussia is to be Protestant, and the Protestant hegemon over Germany. And it's reducing that Austrian influence. But again, his anti-Austrian policy, you know, it had been mitigated with the foresighted realization in 1866 that destroying Austria did not suit Prussia's interests. And again, this is a point which I haven't alluded to, but look at the actual map of Germany here. When Bismarck unites Germany, he has no interest in uniting the ethnos of Germany. And this again substantiates my point that it is a Prussian aggrandizement and not a German unification, because there are millions of German Austrians at this time. And again, even the notion of Austrian as distinct from German doesn't exist really at this point, even after the unification. And Bismarck had no intention of uniting these people with Prussia. And this was for not a reason out of hate, but this was for a very, you know, solid practical reason, which is Prussia had a far more dominant position relative to a Germany without Austria, as opposed to a Germany that included Austria. And so he would rather have a smaller Germany, Kleines Deutschland, which excluded Austria and kept Austria as an ally dealing with its own internal affairs, rather than limit potential Prussian influence within a united Germany. And so
would have been, as the proposals you said, Kleine Deutschland, the opposite would have been a Große Deutschland.
Große Deutschland, which again is pursued immediately after the collapse of Austria in 1918-1919, and successfully accomplished under the mid-century Germans
for a short while
in 1938 until 1945. But nevertheless, moving on to the position of socialism. Oh, and just to confirm this point within diplomatic affairs, at the same time that Bismarck is wooing over the Zentrum Party and the Catholics, he is also wooing the Austrians, because we have the dual alliance in 1879. So again, his internal politics does reflect his foreign politics to some extent. But moving on to...
ethnos very briefly for me. Also, we have to consider as well, and this comes to the fore in the midst of the mid-century Germans and that period as well, is that you still have in totality millions of Germans who live overseas in places such as Belgium, in Luxembourg, in the Sudetenland, in parts of the Russian Polish provinces.
More so than that, in the Baltic provinces, in the Volga region.
Exactly.
So
I'm just adding to that case, because it's quite multifaceted. It's not just Austria, it's elsewhere as well.
Yes. Prussia has no desire to unite all Germans. This isn't a mid-century conception of Heimat ins Reich. This is a Prussian domination over the German statelets, as opposed to Prussian domination over Germans everywhere. Just to emphasize that, and Bismarck's conception of Germany, which is again completely at odds with the mid-century German conception of Germany at the same time. This is where we have, again, one of the most controversial points of Bismarck's position, which is the Staatssozialismus, which was, you know, derisively coined by his former ally, the National Liberals, but also by Bismarck himself, who coined the word or the phrase "die Staatssozialismus paukt sie durch," which means essentially, you know, socialism will nib in, and this was a prophecy he gave in 1881, where doesn't matter sort of my political goals, ultimately it seems we might see the triumph of socialism. And this is essentially what you see, and, you know, illustrated by among others von Hayek, who will elucidate this fact of the road to serfdom. So after having, you know, formed this alliance with Zentrum, from 1878, Bismarck starts taking a very hard line against the socialists. And this is off the back of, you know, all fears of the Paris Commune, obviously, but specifically over two attempted assassinations of the Kaiser Wilhelm, that of Nobling and that of Hodel. And also to limit the rapid expansion of the SPD, the Social Democratic Party. And from 1878 until 1888, Bismarck introduces a series of anti-socialist laws, which were responsible for banning trade unions, 45 socialist newspapers, even the ability for group meetings to discuss socialist ideas. And as we'll see later in German history, after World War II, the banning of party emblems or emblems signifying a certain political allegiance. The final measure of Bismarck was actually to try and denaturalize social democrats, i.e. suspend them having their German citizenship. But this failed. And Bismarck, again, was dismissed shortly after, so it wasn't a position again. But it just shows his commitment to wanting to root out socialism, root and stem. But this wasn't just an aggressive measure. He gave them vast concessions as well. We see here what we're going to see later in Britain during Lloyd George, but on a larger scale, this idea of state socialism. In 1883, we have the Health Insurance Bill, which... It wasn't like a state-centered bill. The idea was to give local bureaus the ability to administer health policies in factories. Ironically, this actually, because they were elected, this actually meant working class influence in these bureaus, which helped the SPD inadvertently. Then we have the Accident Insurance Bill, which was some of the first welfare payments in Germany, which was far more extensive, which basically established both federal and state offices, a massive expansion in the state bureaucracy to deal with this. And I believe it was 2/3 of income would be granted in the event of total disability. It was originally intended for factory workers, and then it extended in 1886 to agricultural workers. And finally, we have the Old Age and Disability Insurance Bill of 1889, which, as we'll see during Lloyd George again, gives pension annuity for those above the age of 70. And again, this causes an issue whether this is going to be organized by the states or by the federal government. And ultimately, this is organized by the states. In terms of a conception for this, I think it's important to note, I did a stream with AA on Disraeli, where I was talking about one nation conservatism. And this is a much grander version of one nation conservatism. It wasn't just dealing with the temporary amelioration of certain conditions on the periphery, such as clean air or better working conditions in the factory. This was creating, supposedly for Bismarck, the working class is eternal loyalty on the state by massively increasing the size of the state to give them gibs to basically be assuaged and placated, and
not in his own words, to take the wind out of the sail of the socialists.
Yes, exactly. So he was conceding that it will be the Prussian state which will be responsible for the peasants' welfare, as opposed to Marxism. And he tried to integrate this in terms of a hierarchical notion, where this is the traditional allegiance of the worker to the aristocrats, and it is the aristocrats, or the in German, the service nobility, the Junker classes, which all the way going back to the Great Elector in the 17th century, and then substantially increased during Frederick II. The idea of the service, the state is a servant of the population, the state is all-encompassing, and the monarch is being the center of this and responsible for the welfare of its populations. This was, if anything, one could argue from a reactionary point of view, this was a dramatic reassertion of that old position, of the centrality of the Prussian state. But of course, from Fernie's Austrian economics gurus in the audience, this will come quite a shock at how Bismarck favored big government. And as we see with the Kulturkampf, it wasn't just big government interference in terms of the economy, because we also see this with Bismarck's protectionism and economic nationalism, mercantilism. But we also see this with his attempt to limit religious education at the same time. So it is, conscientiously, it's a policy of Germanization, all loyalty to the state, and the state is controlled by Bismarck, so by extension, loyalty to him. However, I think it's important to note that if his ultimate goal was to eliminate the socialists forever, he failed completely, because less than 20 years after his dismissal, by 1912, the Social Democrats had become the largest party in Germany. And this was way before the Labour Party in Britain achieved such a similar position. And this was before the war, before you had that massive expansion of socialization of the state. So nevertheless, as you can see, there is an element of truth in what Malinowski, de Ponchamp and Evola say, when they argue that you create this massive state structure whose aim ostensibly is to serve the interests of the monarch, i.e. the plebs, for lack of a better word, the working classes, the agricultural peasantry, are wedded to their support of the state, simply remove the bureaucrats, change their political persuasion, and it seamlessly transfers into a socialist state. And of course, you know, Germany was able to transfer into the Weimar Republic again using the virtually the same bureaucracy at the same time. So he has a complicated legacy when it comes to his domestic policies in Germany. Nevertheless, this wasn't explicitly state socialism, even though Bismarck himself derisively referred to it as such, that it could possibly, you know, mutate into that. Rather, this was, again, an exertion of the Prussian state as supreme in people's lives. And, you know, compared to Britain, you know, the state had far more overarching influence. And again, this was wedded to, you know, classical romantic ideas about the terrible conditions of the working class and the factories. So Bismarck believed that, you know, he's supporting industrialization of the Ruhr on the one hand, so it was only natural for the German state to support the amelioration of the working classes on another. So before we move on to foreign policy, which will be the climax of this discussion, Mark, is there anything you want to talk about the economy in this in particular?
It's just an interesting observation because, I mean, you know, a lot of this audience is obviously from the UK and I'm from Australia and, you know, part of the Commonwealth. And we essentially have not identical laws, but quite similar laws pertaining to economics and what we might call industrial relations and unions and the socio-cultural economic miasma that all exists in. And what we do have in that British sort of Commonwealth Anglosphere context is the trade unions and this you might say standoffish relationship between employers and employees has a really complicated history in the 20th century, and you might say there's a lot of class adversarialism that is thrust into this political atmosphere, and especially in the context of, say, like elections and the role of the trade unions and labor movement in left-wing parties. I mean, You there and me here, we both have Labour parties and they're much the same and they have a similar platform and they have this tight allegiance. But what's interesting is that even though Bismarck in this time period brings in a lot of these social welfare programs and, you know, like I just said previously, Bismarck commented about doing it to take the wind out of the sails of the socialists and you rightly call it Gibbs. But there's an interesting thing that does happen here, and whether it involves the events of the 20th century and the two world wars and what have you, but this is true of Germany, and to some extent also true of Japan, and I cite Japan because sort of Japan is sort of this strange, you know, like semi-Germany in a sense of the East, and certainly in terms of like from an industrialization and production context, is that there's still a role for trade unions, and there's still this you know, this concept of labor and labor laws and a very labor-driven economy, and increasingly so over time as these nations industrialize. But they don't have this really bitter class adversarialism that's driven by trade unionism and its sort of interwoven relationship with politics as we've seen in the Anglosphere. It's just a strange thing I picked up on as you were talking. I don't know if it's relevant, but it's just interesting.
Well, it's interesting and relevant because you see this today in the modern state of Germany, where there is much less friction between the trade unions and the government, where there is, and again, all of these schemes that I outlined, the intention was that trade union officials, factories, and the state would work in tandem. So this unity and collaboration of these factions, you know, working as a whole, for the benefit
actually,
of the
state. That's a good word. That's a very good term. A collaborative relationship certainly seems to be the case here. And I mean, I don't know if AA would ever listen to this or will hear this, but it would be an interesting talking point, you know, that distinction between the Commonwealth and the British culture of labor and say like the Germanic Japanese culture, considering both societies were quite similarly industrialized, but they went in very different directions in terms of the relationships between labor and economy. It's just an interesting point that, you know, could be explored down the track.
Absolutely. And if it's all right, we'll move beyond.
Absolutely.
The,
don't
want to
put it down. Let's rock and roll. Yeah.
But again, I think we've established the main points regarding Bismarck and his complicated legacy. Now we get to foreign policy. And
fun and games. Bismarck's imagination.
Fun and games. But just to point it out, that put it out there, that like Metternich, Bismarck, during his tenure as the honest broker of Europe, which again is an epithet that he seriously sought to embrace, was able to prevent any sort of serious sort of conflagration in Europe. There were a couple of exceptions. You know, the main exception during his time was, of course, the Russo-Turkish War of 1878. Nevertheless, he was also, you know, the principal peace broker during that, along with Benjamin Disraeli, who he sort of affectionately referred to as the Alter Jude. But nevertheless, he was more or less successful in stabilizing the European situation. And first of all, as I mentioned, he had a very affectionate relationship with Russia, you know, going back to his time as ambassador to Russia during the late 1850s and early 1860s. He had relied on Russia neutrality in order to achieve the unification of Germany. And, you know, Russia had acquiesced to it so long as Germany was committed, you know, against the unification of Poland. And so when we have the creation of the Three Emperors League, which is, you know, one of the early innovations, it is the restoration of the earlier Holy League established by Metternich. So very much Bismarck is obviously trying to imitate Metternich, but also it is explicitly, you know, aimed for two reasons. One is to curtail Polish nationalism, because all three nations have significant Polish populations: Austria in Galicia, Lodomeria, Prussia in Congress Poland, and Germany in Silesia, Posen, and West Prussia. The other aim of this, of course, is the isolation of France. And we've already explained that Bismarck was more than willing to interfere in the politics of France to try and undermine its domestic stability, even if that meant, you know, undermining the conservative cause in Europe as a whole. Of course, we've already mentioned that Prussia had a very effective relationship with Italy, which did, you know, serve them well during the Austro-Prussian War, even though it wasn't decisive. And this is interesting because it actually puts in perspective how his alliance with Austria, again, which he had spared during the Austro-Prussian War, so he could later rely on Austria as an ally, and, you know, for the various reasons we've outlined, such as his desire not to create a greater Germany, actually causes major problems when it comes to his alliance with Italy and Russia. So as you can see on this map, it shows that the Emperor's League breaks apart several times. You know, the first reason it breaks apart is because the dual alliance, it looks like Germany is actually favoring Austria-Hungary over Russia. And during the Turkish War, as I mentioned, in 1878, we have the Congress of Berlin. And Bismarck actually, again, rather than advocating for Russia's role in expansion at the expense of Turkey, basically acquiesced to Disraeli's pressure, which is to seriously limit the size of Bulgaria and therefore Russian influence in the region in favor of Turkey. So in terms of like what Russia can actually gain from this alliance, other than, you know, a peaceable Western Front and security against, you know, Polish uprisings, Germany is not prepared to back Russia up in the Balkans. In fact, it's Bismarck's explicit policy not to intervene on one side during the Balkans. So Bismarck is again trying to not satiate the desire of either Austria or Russia to expand into that region, even though Austria will expand slightly by militarily occupying Bosnia and Herzegovina, which they will annex in 1808. Then, as I mentioned, we have the Triple Alliance. Now, this is, I don't have a map for this, but this is another important little featurette, which is the Conference of Berlin, or the Scramble for Africa. Bismarck explicitly did not want colonies as part of his diplomatic game. He believed colonies would overcomplicate Germany's position. However, he was motivated to, you know, acquire colonies, and by this, you know, German West Africa and in Namibia and German East Africa and in Tanzania, and later they would acquire Cameroon as well. The reason for the acquisition of these colonies was that, as you can see, after the Franco-Prussian War, something we've failed to mention, which is, I don't know how we failed to mention it because it's so significant, is that during the Franco-Prussian War afterwards, Germany annexed Alsace and Lorraine, which basically ensured the perpetual enmity of France and Germany, another reason to isolate France from the great game of power politics. But also, and that had been driven more by popular opinion than by Bismarck's own desire, because again, he couldn't fight a war so decisively against France, win, and then go and turn around to the German nationalists and say, actually, no, this predominantly German-speaking region of France, Alsace-Lorraine, which become Alsace-Lothringen, can't become German because it would upset the French. You know, that was a ridiculous position. So we had no actual power to stop, you know, calls for the annexation of Alsace-Lorraine.
Just and on that very point, very briefly, on Alsace-Lorraine, he was also under a lot of pressure from von Moltke and the command that actually want they wanted a bridgehead over the Rhine into
absolutely.
France as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Sorry, it's very important, but again, it's also a very important economic region as well.
Yes.
Because
yes,
it took away a large part of France's capacity to, you know, use iron at the same time.
Yes,
so it was an industrial region, it was an ethnically German region, and as Marcus said, strategically it pushed the German border from the Rhine further into France. So for many reasons, other than the diplomatic repercussions of alienating France forever. And of course, there's that famous image of the schoolboy pointing to the lost provinces. And this is the idea of revanchism or revenge in foreign policy. The same sort of thing can be seen with the acquisition of colonies. It suited popular desire at home, and it also supported Germany's economic policy, as it had adopted a mercantilist or protectionist foreign policy in the late 1870s. There was now a need for Germany to acquire resources because it was relying on its import tariffs. And so the idea of acquiring these colonies would also coincide with the acquisition of provinces. And you have a couple of quotes you want to bring in here, Marcus. So go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah, sure. By all means. So pertaining to his positions on colonies, he had two contrasting positions, which actually changed in relatively short order. And can you just continue? I actually just lost my notes. Just bear with me for a few seconds.
Oh, sure. I think it's also important to note when it comes back to the Austrian and Russian alliance that one of the fundamental points of contention between Austria and Russia was the so-called Great Betrayal. You know, the Holy League had existed since the time of Metternich, and it was during the Crimean War that the Austrians not only sided against the Russians, but even threatened to declare war after the Russians under Nicholas had actually stabilized the internal situation in the Austrian Empire and reincorporated Hungary back into the Habsburg realms. And this was seen as the Great Betrayal. So the wedding of Russia and Austria was always going to be, you know, incredibly tumultuous, and Bismarck had to use, you know, incredible diplomatic deft of hand in order to achieve it. And because the Three Kaisers League kept breaking down because of Russia's intractable problems with Austria and now its expanding influence to the Balkans, now the Ottoman Empire was breaking down, Bismarck in 1887 concluded the secret reinsurance treaty, which actually promised Russia that in the event of a war, both sides will remain neutral. So again, he was undermining his allies and using his own personal diplomatic flair to satisfy all parties whilst promising each faction different things. And this is going to be one of the main reasons why the Foreign Office turns on him in 1890. But before we get to the dismissal of Bismarck, Marcus, have you found those quotes on the colonial situation?
Yes, I have. Sorry, just it's a bit of tightness at my end. I apologize, chat. So Bismarck's attitude to efforts in the colonial policy as of 1881 was thus, right? So he affirmed, as long as I am Chancellor of the Reich, we will not pursue a colonial policy. Yet by September of 1884, he had said this: the single aim of German colonial policy is to drive a wedge between the Crown Prince and England. So within a very short space of time, he's had a complete reorientation on colonial policy. Moreover, he's been willing to compromise his position on policies to effect very principally and in a very purposeful manner the relationship between the heir of his own realm, of Imperial Germany, and Prince Fritz's relationship with England via his wife. And just the second small point I want to enter, because we're talking about colonial policy, we're talking about an age which ships move from sail to coal power. And the problem is, in Germany's case, is once they start acquiring a colony here, a colony there, whether it's Southwest Africa, whether it's Tanganyika, they have this intractable problem as they expand the navy, which actually occurs sort of towards the end of Bismarck's tenure as Chancellor and as Minister President. The Germans have to have sufficient bases around the world where they can actually refuel and re-equip and rest their crews as for their expanding navy. So they can't just have a colony in Africa and one in North Papua and be done with it. Germany has to play the game in a broad sense to be able to facilitate the control of the colonial empire, which causes more complications for their foreign policy and also affects them economically.
Absolutely. And Weltpolitik, as we're now moving on from Machtpolitik or Realpolitik or Europolitik, is going to be, you know, significant in the dismissal of Bismarck. So it carries over. You mentioned Frederick again, and one important thing to re-emphasize is the fact that Frederick had basically been completely relegated, you know, from all sort of positions of political influence by Bismarck, again, due to this paranoia pertaining to his influence, despite the fact that he was, you know, an incredibly capable soldier and had served with distinction during all of these wars.
Absolutely, and especially in the War of 1871.
Yes, exactly. So in 1888, Wilhelm dies in his 90s. He comes to the throne at a very old age, and amazingly, he lives that long. And this emphasizes actually how important the relationship of Bismarck to the king was. As you explained, you know, he was able to cajole the king into basically giving Bismarck supreme power and also allowing himself, the king, to be isolated. And this carried on into the imperial reign as well. And so Bismarck decides that because Frederick is a liberal and Frederick is basically contaminated, that he's going to woo the grandson of Wilhelm. He's going to woo the future Wilhelm II, who just so it happens has a very tumultuous relationship with his mother and has adopted basically the opposite political position to the crown, to Prince Albert, the Prince Consort, in that he favors the Prussian state, he favors the army, and he favors royal absolutism. In fact, he wants to be an absolute monarch. And so Bismarck allows Willy, as he's, you know, affectionately known, to go to the Foreign Office instead of his father, which is, you know, ridiculous, priming this boy to be emperor.
And he serves under Holstein, doesn't he, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes, under Friedrich von Holstein, to be political secretary at the Foreign Office.
Yes.
And when it comes to Friedrich in the year 1888 has lung cancer. So when he finally comes to the throne in his 50s, he is unable to speak. He's so ill, he's unable to attend the funeral of his father. And he only reigns for 99 days, where he's effectively incapacitated the entire time. And this allows Willy, now Wilhelm II, to become emperor in what was the year of the three emperors in 1888. And funnily enough, Bismarck took this to be a triumph because, you know, he had avoided the liberal monarch taking over. And now he had what he considered to be a puppet who was more or less ideologically in line with him to take the throne. But of course, that wasn't the case. Bismarck demanded sort of the total isolation of the monarch, and he demanded almost the total allegiance, in the sense that diplomatic dispatches would be sent off, or all information would go through him, and ministers could not consult with the king emperor without, you know, going through the chancellor. All of these things were incredibly unstable, because this entirely relied on a royal order which had been established, I think, in 1851. Which prevented the cabinet members individually meeting with the king. And so all it took was the emperor to reverse the previous order, and Bismarck's entire actual position could be nullified. I think also important to mention that he had, as I said, a fractious relationship with the Reichstag, and he was always flipping his alliances, you know, from a series of factions to other factions. And it was just at this time, 1889 and 1890, that he'd lost his parliamentary majority at the same time.
Now, it could be said at this point that Bismarck had definitely expended an awful lot of domestic political goodwill.
Yes, and as I mentioned, you know, he'd already probably lost a significant amount of goodwill through the culture camp and through the socialism policy, especially with the Prussian conservative nobility. But also, we mentioned von Roon and we mentioned Helmut von Moltke. Both of these characters have been incredibly, you know, instrumental in solidifying Bismarck's power, because through them he was able to control the army. Because technically, the Kaiser was the commander in chief; he was the supreme warlord, and so Bismarck had to rely on these ministers in order to have any influence over the army. And that goes back to the Steinberg quote, referring to the fact that even though he'd been, you know, increasingly ennobled, you know, going from Graf von Bismarck to Fürst von Bismarck, and promoted, you know, to I think ultimately to colonel general in the army with the dignity of Feldmarschall, field marshal. I think it's important to note that Bismarck again wasn't a military commander. He was reliant on this network that he had built up. Roon dies in 1879, and Moltke retires in 1888, you know, in his late 80s, and he dies in 1891 in his 90s. So all of his original allies are dying. And to make matters worse, his principal ally in the Foreign Office, Friedrich von Holstein, who had, you know, arisen during the original controversy with Harry von Arnim, which, you know, many could consider him to be like a grey eminence of Bismarck's foreign policy. And Bismarck referred to von Holstein as the hyena. He was lobbying the Emperor Wilhelm against Bismarck. He was arguing how, you know, his double dealing and his contrary promises to Russia were making the situation in Europe incredibly unstable. For example, I'm pointing out to the Emperor that I believe he had promised Russia that he would not object to the Russians occupying the Bosphorus Straits, i.e. Constantinople. And because now the Wilhelm believed that Britain was the natural ally of Germany, he wanted to pursue a pro-British policy. This Russian policy was getting in the way, and also believed that Wilhelm had more superficial, fickle, and personal reasons for disliking Russia, because it's no surprise that the Emperor of Russia, Alexander III, despised Wilhelm, believing him to be a complete buffoon. So taking this seriously,
a rather snotty little boy, you know.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. What was another quote? A spoilt boy of bad, you know, bad temperament and bad faith, and you know all yes. these. But yes, of course.
And that was in personal correspondence to Bismarck, by the way.
Yes, which he intercepted, yes. Yeah. So there are many reasons why the Emperor fumed over this treatment.
You there? Hello.
You know, it was the...
we have another audio glitch. Okay, you're back, I can hear you.
Oh, yes, right. Okay, great. So yes, in addition to that, I mean, there's just a cavalcade of problems. The Kaiser, there's this strike in Westphalia, and Bismarck wants to send in the army. You're essentially believing that, you know, they haven't worked through the proper channels which he set up. You know, this is clearly socialist agitation. You know, we'll just deal with this by sending in the army. And Wilhelm uses this as an opportunity to make a grand promise to ameliorate the working class situation in Germany personally, not through the ministries, which are again loyal to Bismarck, even going as far to set up a Continental Council on labor. And Bismarck, again, believing that this is just subversion of Wilhelm against him, you know, frustrates these plans. And so during the reign of Wilhelm I, there had been many attempts where, you know, he had threatened resignation, Bismarck, in order to get his way. And essentially, in one of these situations, there was this epic row between Wilhelm II and Bismarck, where he again threatened to resign. And rather than being cajoled by this, Wilhelm, believing he now had the supporters to go alone and pursue his new foreign policy, which Bismarck despised, that of expanding, you know, Germany's influence across the world and focusing on, you know, naval expansion, you know, ultimately through the Tirpitz plan. You know, he despised this. He believed this was incredibly reckless. Took this opportunity, you know, of him again forcing the hand of resignation, to accept the resignation, ostensibly under ill health, because Bismarck at this time was 75. And in response, Bismarck goes into this very angry, frustrated retirement, where he breaks all of the rules he had established, say, for example, with von Arnim, you know, releasing documents, trying to embarrass the Kaiser, you know, writing his memoirs, Thoughts and Memories, and having no opportunity to offer a jab at the Kaiser Wilhelm. I think even the epitaph on his tomb read, a loyal servant of Wilhelm I. all of these little jibes, again, aimed at undermining, you know, the ego of the the new emperor. And I think the tragedy, of course, is that the Kaiser didn't renew the reinsurance treaty, therefore aiding in the destabilization of Europe, because Bismarck was fully aware that Russia needed to be allied with Germany in order to ensure that there would be no encirclement and that France would remain diplomatically isolated. But under Leo von Caprivi, who was the new chancellor, and von Holstein, who was now the preeminent influence in the Foreign Office as political secretary, they gravitated towards Britain. But, you know, the ultimate effect of this was in 1894, Russia and France would sign the Franco-Russo alliance. And this would have, you know, dramatic effects for the situation in Europe. And this would basically represent the undoing of Bismarck's crowning achievement during his 20 years of chancellor and foreign minister, which was the isolation of France. I don't want to sort of go down too much down the road of fatalism in World War One, because I have quite a complex position, and this isn't the stream to do that. But nevertheless,
it certainly brings about the conditions for Germany's ultimate nightmare of a two-front war. We can at least cap it off there. I think that's probably...
absolutely. But I think that's a good place to stop. So I think any sort of closing remarks on Bismarck, so just to give my own, just quickly. He was clearly, it's incredible that he was able to take Prussia, which was considered almost the least of the great powers of Europe. The great powers, of course, being Great Britain, France, Austria, and Russia. And he was able to transform it in the space of his career into the preeminent power in Europe, and really in the world, second only to the United States, which wasn't a military power, but an economic power at this time. And he had done so without relying on, a political party. He had done so through sheer force of will, controlling the monarch. And in terms of the effects on the German political system, I think what's important to note is that the fatal flaw in Germany's constitution going forward is that it relied on a centralizing figure like Bismarck. Because when you removed Bismarck, who had been the center of the Reichstag disputes, who had been the center of the Foreign Office, who had been the center of the Chancellery, who had been the conduit between the government and the cabinet and the monarch, once you remove the Bismarck figure, the chancellorship is diminished, certainly, because now Wilhelm can consult with other ministers, and the chancellorship becomes one of a competing series of powers across the next 30 years in the remainder of the Kaiserreich, of the Wilhelmine period. The army, has a prominent role. The Kaiser adopts a more prominent role in terms of the traditional role of a king, which is that of foreign policy. And then, of course, the Reichstag is exerting itself. So when we get to World War One, we have four competing power blocks, namely the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, who is, the head of the civil service, effectively. We have the Kaiser, and we have the Reichstag, which is now dominated by socialist representatives. And we have the army led by the nephew of Helmut von Moltke the Younger, Helmut von Moltke the Younger. So again, you can say that Bismarck essentially left a fatal flaw in the German political system, which no politician subsequently was able to fill. And in fact, Wilhelm had no desire for any politician to fill it, hence why he picked Leo von Caprivi as his next chancellor, believing that he wasn't nearly as ambitious as Bismarck.
Yeah, I think that sort of caps off the Bismarckian period quite nicely, and really does set us up for, if we venture into the start of World War One or that thing down the track, we've got a good basis point, because really having those four competing positions does, in some ways, answer the questions as to how Germany does tumble into the First World War based upon the circumstances in which it finds itself, with the Ottoman Empire crumbling in the aftermath of the Balkan Wars and the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. There's this sort of intra-branch competition within Germany, all tugging at the attention of Kaiser Wilhelm, who's something of a vain sort of, and the analysis of the Tsar is quite accurate. He's kind of a vain, almost superficial, haughty man who can be tugged one direction or another depending on which of his sort of lackeys gets his attention first, and it has disastrous consequences for Germany, the nation, and the German people, and everybody who suffers the worst impacts of the First World War.
Wonderful, thank you for those comments, Marcus. I think this has been the longest episode of Heterodox. We're getting longer than our usual broadcast, but I think it was necessary in order to elucidate all of these points, which are really, really quite significant. And hopefully we've hammered home how important a figure Bismarck is. And sadly, due to the events of the 20th century, Bismarck is in many ways a underappreciated figure because of the more recent historiography. And it's only recently that, you know, Bismarck has, you know, again been taken more seriously, and he really needs to be, because as we've demonstrated, he really is at the center of European politics for 30 years. He's a towering and influential figure, and also someone from, you know, a certain sort of political persuasion where we can learn potentially a lot from. So getting on to the super chats, Marcus 588 for $3 Australian says, as AA might say, this material is buy tens for tens. Well, that's very kind of you, Marcus 588. I'm not sure whether I'm a 10 yet. I'm sure.
Fellow Marcus, we will endeavour to be tens if we're not quite tens.
I'm sure there are a lot of tens in the audience, but hopefully we're working our way to tens nevertheless.
Yes.
Mr. Patriarch for 14 South African rand. Uber interesting topic. Excited to watch later. Well, hopefully when you watch later, it'll be interesting at least. So thank you very much, Mr. Patriarch. Giraffe Deity for $10. For a gavel to be applied ordinarily in your never-ending fight to hurry Marcus and Columbo to the next topic, your streams have been an amazing learning experience. Well, thank you, Giraffe Deity. I think in my, what was it, my debate about the American War of Independence, I use a glass and a spoon, but maybe a gavel will be quite interesting addition.
It's not a vine staff, AM, not a vine staff.
So that's great. So before we go, Marcus, anything you want to shill?
I don't have anything to shill as usual. Just if anyone wants to follow me on Twitter, they're welcome to. I only have one request because I didn't get a chance to do so. May I share my favorite Bismarck quote before we end?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
It's very succinct, actually, which is unusual for me. Bismarck says, "The people never lie so much as before an election, during a war, and after a hunt."
Wonderful.
And I think, and I actually have a list of quotes here, and sadly I really got to none of them because you beat me to one of them, and then I didn't get a chance to read the others. But I think if nothing else, if we accept that Bismarck is a brilliant but flawed man of his time, a titan of politics, but ultimately his work ended up being undone after his life had expired, we can still appreciate the fact that he was a really one of the giants of the 19th century and a real fundamental figure of German history broadly, never mind just modern history. And I'm so glad that we're able to evaluate him with a plethora of his contemporary sources and our contemporary sources, and bring light to him, because I think sadly, like you say, he's a misunderstood figure, and definitely from the liberal side of politics he's somewhat maligned as being sort of this coarse reactionary. And I think Bismarck does deserve better, and hopefully we've made a very, very small but a modest but worthwhile contribution to changing that.
Wonderful. As you can see, thank you to all my patrons. I just want to make this like a thing on my streams now, so I have some way of thanking all of you wonderful people for contributing to this channel. If you like this content, please like, share, and subscribe. It means so much. Thank you all again for watching this content. Thank you for Marcus for being such a stellar guest. And good night.
Oh, and good night, everyone.
Oh, and one thing. Actually, no, I don't need to comment on it. Good night.
Good night, everyone.